Hello, and welcome to the Etonicast. I'm Alex Roy, and as always, we have my trusty co-host, Edward Niedermeyer. Hello, Ed.
Hey, Alex.
Today, we have one of the most fascinating people in the automotive industry, whose name is associated with BMW and flame surfacing, but has done a lot more work and a lot more important work in recent years. We have Chris Bangle. Welcome, Mr. Bangle.
Hi, guys.
Ed, do you want to lead this off, or may I?
Please go.
So, Chris, you have been very closely associated with, the concept of flame surfacing and really bringing BMW into a new era of design, but really inspiring the entire automotive industry. In recent years, you've set up Chris Bangle and Associates. Tell us a little bit about that and what we most recently saw at the LA Auto Show.
When I joined BMW, I was 35 years old back then. You kind of don't really have a really clear idea what a career path is for a design director. But after a while, it seemed when I was about 45, it seemed that around about the year when I turned 50, it was going to be a pretty good idea for me, health-wise, mentally, any other way you want to put it, if I stepped out of an OEM. Because 15 years in that seat it's pretty tough on anybody. And I actually stayed another 2 years after that. So I left after 17 years. But when I was 45, my wife and I started thinking about what would be the next phase of our life. And we decided that we liked Italy a lot and we wanted to come back here and do it in a manner which would allow me to put together a design studio that would attract young people, would attract talent, would attract clients as well, because this area of Northern Italy, we're about an hour south of Torino in the wine area of the Piemonte called the Langa. This area seemed like a really nice place to make that happen. And it took us about, 7 years of 5 years of looking and 2 years of building to have the place ready. And then we began our studio here when I left BMW. So our goal was to have, and it still is, to have a place where creatives can come, where clients can feel that they are associates too. That's why we didn't call it Chris Bangle Design. It's called Chris Bangle Associates, because I wanted everybody who's a stakeholder in the process, not just my designers, but the clients and their managers and their marketers and engineers and anybody, to really feel that they have buy-in on this and that they are participants in it. They are associates. And since we started it in 2009, we've had all kinds of clients outside of the automotive industry for everything from bottles to spaceships to super yachts to nursing homes. We've done about everything. And also in the OEMs of the car business, I was consulting a lot, but very much on the sense of management of how you deal with designers, et cetera, not so much on the product. I was not really happy about just doing a car like another car design studio might do it. Then came this project from a Chinese company called CHTC, China High Tech Company, which is a central China government backed technology company. They basically deal with big duty hardware like machines for weaving, things like that. But they had gotten into trucks and buses and electric vehicles that way and wanted to do a car. And they wanted to do it in an entirely different manner, which was, how do we do something that's just right for people? And let's forget what it should look like another car or should remind us of something else. Let's just start with the fact that China's megacities have some clear challenges. And how can we make life for those people better with an electric car? And we started with that a couple of years ago. And the end result we showed as REDS for the company Red Space. That's what CHTC decided to call their car company. REDS for Red Space. And we showed that at Los Angeles just in November.
What's really interesting about REDS is that there's this kind of binary visual language between human-driven vehicles and everything that falls under the umbrella of mobility. And most things that are considered future vehicles look like these kind of shapeless, amorphous pods. But the REDS vehicle is very distinct and different from almost everything else that we hear from the mobility camp. So tell us a little bit about that vehicle, because it's I don't even know how to describe it. Language fails almost everyone except Robert Cumberford when trying to explain vehicle design. But you would call yourself an industrial designer. Is that not true?
No, I'm a car designer.
Okay. And yet you've worked on many things that are not cars. Explain to us kind of a little bit of the thinking behind the REDS vehicle.
Okay. I will tell you something we might want to come back to later on what car design is to me. And car design is not about four wheels and an object on it. So at the end of this discussion, let's come back to that if you
like. I'd like very much.
Because my studio is doing cartoons right now, and I'm sure you want to know what cartoons have to do with car design.
I can imagine. So,
okay, anyway, so this was a deal. We didn't actually do any exterior designs of this vehicle. We started with a very small package. The client wanted a vehicle about the size of a Smart. You know, this is two-seater vehicles. They're very short. He wanted a car with a kind of a footprint. We wanted to do it in a way that really, really, really offered a lot to people. And it turns out in our studies that particularly in China, but actually everywhere in the world, vehicles don't move for like 90% of their life. They're just stopped. Either they're stopped in traffic or they're stopped parking. And many people think that parking a vehicle, a stop vehicle parking means you get out of it immediately and you're not even there for it. But for a lot of people, particularly in a place where it's difficult to have your own apartment, you know, maybe you have a young child that you just don't want to wake up when you open them. A lot of people spend time in their cars not moving just because it's the best place to be. Listen to some music, play a video game with a friend, have a chat with a best friend maybe, or like I said, you know, spend time with your child, even change a diaper. Anyway, we quickly discovered that no car is designed for that 90% of the time when it's not moving. Everything is sacrificed for the 10% when it is moving. Well, a megacity vehicle doesn't go that fast. The aerodynamics is not that big a deal when you're down under 120 kilometers an hour. So we thought, let's try and do one that really allows you to live your life in a completely free and easy manner when the car's not moving. And then we'll make it drive too. You know, it'll drive really fun. But when it's not moving is when it's really showing you something that no other car can do. So we made interior mock-ups for about 2 years without a single drawing of what it could look like. And we decided rather quickly that the way to do it was to make the seats turn around so that you could see each other when you're stopped and do it without having to open the doors. At the Geneva Motor Show just recently, I saw about three or four other concepts where you could turn the seats around, but none of those could do it with the doors shut. So this one, you could do it with the doors shut. You can stretch out and relax even when the guy in front of you is driving. We offset the seats in a manner that allows to do that. But in any case, all of these changes in the interior package, which made it very livable, resulted in a form with, for instance, a reversed front windshield that actually leans out at the top and not back, and straight up and down sides. It has a huge long roof because those long overhangs, of course, make for that, which is a good thing for an electric car because that puts the interior in shadow and it doesn't build up a heat load from the sun. And that, of course, makes air conditioning easier and stuff like that. Doesn't eat into your range. All of this made for a really livable car, but the exterior shape was really, really unusual. You've seen it. You know what I mean. It's kind of silhouette, looks like a figure eight, you know, wide at the top and then narrow at the waist and then wide out again at the bottom. And when we were doing it, we were very, very much aware of the fact that people have little boxes in their heads that they put things in that they know what they are. Like we have a box for SUVs, we have a box for station wagons, we have a box for Porsche, we have a box for Mercedes. And we know when somebody tells you, look, this goes in that box and it doesn't fit, we know there's something weird. And it kind of can fall between the boxes and then that's not a good thing. People don't know what to do with the design. They can't identify. And the shape that we had was definitely working towards that kind of wacky, you know, like you said, future mobile that has no sense whatsoever, just an oddball-ism. And this was very, very dangerous, we felt. And so we thought of how do we get around that? And the discussion came up in the studio that we should not approach this car holistically, try to make it one thing. We should split the design into layers that allow you to see something that you understand. And then later you can discover the stuff that maybe visually you didn't understand, but once you experience it by sitting in it, you go, oh, that's really cool. So the actual outside look of the car is not the car itself. The outside look is of a little kid's car. In fact, if you notice that, it kind of looks like a kiddie car. And when you see that first, I think it allows people to find a spot in their minds for it because we all have boxes for kiddie cars. And you go, okay, tick, I get what it is. But then you're allowed time to look at it again and get into it and suddenly realize there's these other layers. And you can't put them all together in your head at once. This car defies me, you know, one of the creators of it here, it defies me to actually put it in a single description. I have to describe it and see it in my mind in layers. And I hope that's going to be the secret to its success. It certainly was very popular in LA.
Well, what's so interesting about it is that it looks like the type of vehicle that if an anime designer was hired by a Japanese manufacturer, they would design, and yet they're all too afraid to make a bold statement. So this comes back to your comment about comic books, I suppose.
Oh, do you want me to return to that?
I would love very much, because this looks like this is where that came from.
Well, you know, yes and no. There's a great word out there that is being underused right now. I learned it from my son. It's the word instantiation with two T's, instantiation. Mm-hmm. And it means to make tangible an intangible concept, which I think is a wonderful word. You know, we don't use this a lot, but there's a lot of things that are intangible that we talk about, we say this word, and everybody thinks they know what it means. But it's not until you actually see it that you go, okay, I get it. And I believe that car design is about taking the intangibleness of what a character is, what a personality is, and making it tangible. We are the instantiators of character. For instance, and I use this often, a Jaguar is a fantastic car. And if you show people one of the Jaguar products and tell them, look, you can see the spirit of Jaguar in this, right? You can see the feline approach to it. You can see the jungle predator instinct that they've given this car. And everybody will nod their head and go, yeah, yeah, I get it. It's a Jaguar. Yeah, yeah. But then you point out the fact, you know, there's no little fuzzy ears and there's no tail and they didn't put a little wet nose on it. But still, you see Jaguar. Well, I felt this is very important because if we want to put character into things in our life around us to make them more appealing to us and more easy to use and accept in our lives, we can't always do it by putting little hands and feet and eyeballs on them. And particularly, this is an issue when you get into robotics. Right now, the robotics community is obsessed with the idea they're a bunch of Geppettos and everything they do has to look like a little person. And this is, to me, completely cattywampus, because it's okay if the thing is about 2 feet tall and it looks cutesy and wanders around like a 3-year-old. But a robot that size ain't going to do you a lot. It's not going to pick you out of bed. It's not going to hold you when you're sick. It's not going to revive. You know, it just physically isn't big enough to do what it might need to do. But the minute you use that same approach and scale it up, you've got this, you know, this Terminator type thing that just scared the shit out of you, right? I mean, this is the problem. This is this uncanny valley that no matter what you do, you really wind up into difficulty because it looks like it wants to be a person. And we believe that the car design approach would not be that. The car design approach would be give it a personality, give it a sense of identity, but don't make it look like a person. We did a robot here called Bunny the Cocktail Waitress, and she kind of looks like a cocktail waitress. You know, she's, you know, in a really, fictionalized format, like we overdid every one of the tropes, you know, put bling on her and gave her a gesture. And she kind of, you can see her holds the tray in one arm, like she's snacking her gum and saying, you know, what you want, buddy. And Bunny, the cocktail waitress robot, was a lot of fun to do because we didn't make her look anything like a woman. She basically looks like one of those hourglass shaped shakers for mixing cocktails. And that's enough to get across the idea. So when we did things like bottles and other things that we worked on, we tried to give them as much character as possible in it with the spirit that car designers have. I think that's the real added value. No other design profession does that. And when we did cartoons, just to finish on our cartoons, the cartoons we're doing, we're making things that are alive in our cartoon, but we're not giving them eyeballs or hands or feet or clothes to wear like you would maybe in a Disney Pixar film. We're doing it in a manner in which it's just the gesture of the object itself that has to communicate its sense of being.
Project Reds, when I saw it in LA, it struck me as being kind of architectural in a way. And what you're talking about is sort of starting with a livable space, even sort of the almost passive solar aspect of the roof. All kind of reminds me of how I my father works with old houses and has worked with, you know, building new houses and stuff. And it just reminds me a little bit of that sort of thinking about how you think about architectural design, particularly like homes. And what you mentioned about 90% cars sitting for 90% of the time. I mean, that's, you know, when it's not moving, I mean, it's essentially a little house, right? And it seems like this design recognizes that. Is there sort of a broader collision between architectural design and automotive design?
You're dead on with this. We lifted whole chapters out of postmodernist architecture to try and understand where to go with this car. So you're right on that. The second issue brought up is this livable space, like the little houses and things like that. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked me the other day, you know, what's the future of the automobile and self-driving and all that stuff? And I said, well, it ain't rocket science, but it is plumbing. I mean, the frontier of having a toilet in your car is, you know, the one unspeakable concept that's keeping, let's say, autonomous mobility from truly achieving its potential. And, well, it ain't rocket science, but it is plumbing.
Yeah.
So I think Red's worked on a concept which the Chinese informed us of this idea of fourth space. First and second space is your works and your living space, your home space. Depends on what country you live on, if the work is first or the home is first. But let's say first and second are that. Third space would be some social space. We're not talking internet, you know, virtual space. We're talking physical ones. Like, let's say Starbucks or something where you meet your friends or things like that. That would be the third space. But the fourth space, which is an emerging as a need, is the space for you. You know, it's like my space. I can go there and be me. I can invite people in if I want, but it's not my home, which has to have a particular setup. And it's not my job, which, you know, kind of belongs to somebody else, that space. And it's certainly not some, you know, place like a coffee shop. It's my space. So we think when we introduced it in LA, we said it's a space that decided to become a car. And I think it's that fourth space.
Wow.
Fascinating.
Yeah. You pulled the book on postmodernist architecture. It's a really fascinating idea. I mean, can you just talk about maybe some specific aspects of that went into this particular car?
When you talk to designers about what deconstructivism means, they almost always will pull some fractal pictures at you and say it has to do with taking a surface or a volume and splitting it into components and breaking it apart and things like that. And that really is not what deconstructivism is. It is actually a philosophical concept which comes from linguists about how we understand and know what we're speaking about, which is everything to do with, you know, the linear action of language as opposed to nonlinear action. So, for instance, these linguists in the postmodernists, the deconstructivists, were rejecting the idea of, let's say, a linguistic notion being like a tree where you have a solid trunk that branches out then in ever more finely defined areas as it goes up, and using a ribosome, you know, like a root, which is one of these types of like roots that just spread out and they have tendrils everywhere. And there is no beginning and there is no end. It's just a continuum. And this is what the architects picked up on in the 70s and the 80s. And the 90s and the postmodernist architects really understood this philosophy far better than I believe designers do with their application of the word. And the deconstructivist architects turned this into a philosophical approach which broke away from the linear sense of an object and got it into a kind of a multiplicity of layering. We've learned from them the idea of textual, text being like a text on a paper, like a reading text. And in fact, we say that Red's is textual, as if it was three pages in a book. You know, each page tells you something. There's the kiddie car page of text. There's the interior volume page of text. There's this also welcoming matte color shape on the side of the car, which is like a text. And just like a book, you can read every page individually, but you can't superimpose all three texts on top of each other and try to make sense of it. And this is something that the architects have really studied and understood well. If you tell anybody what is, let's say, a Swiss chalet in their head, They have probably the same picture you and I have. And if you ask them to draw it, they could probably do a commendable job of getting down like a house with these little bar sticks that break up the outside of it as the structure. And then this long overhangs on the roof. And okay, it's a Swiss chalet. So we all know it. But try and do the same thing with, let's say, Frank Gehry's museum in Bilbao. We all know it. Everybody knows what it is, but try and draw it. You can't.
So it seems that when you... And when you talked about the Jaguar, how it inspires it to kind of picture, project, you know, its feline aspects. The Jaguars are very organic forms. And going back in time, I guess before the 70s, most, you know, kind of sports cars or cars that were the most inspiring to us were very organic shapes. But, you know, it looks like your very best designs, which have been the most controversial, stand in opposition to that, inspired by this postmodernism. So I don't really feel like anything you've done was inspired by other automotive design. What non-automotive designers have inspired you?
Well, I let me make a comment, first of all, on your description of what I've done in the past. I think you're referring to many of the cars we did at BMW.
Yes, largely, yes.
We even carry the moniker Flame Servicing. And I know you know this, but I'll just repeat it for your listeners. Those cars are created by wonderful teams of designers and engineers and technicians and modelers. And as a design director, you have the privilege of standing in front of people and presenting the cars. But it should really be understood as being the effort of all these creatives. And those cars were made by great, great designers who went on to have great careers themselves. And I never want to be, you know, in their way for claiming any of that work. I just had the great privilege to direct it. Having said that, the cars were dramatic because they tried to solve some very particular problems that cars have with volumes and shapes and visual gesture and weight. They were trying to solve it in a non-traditional manner. As cars got bigger, the traditional way to solve the sense of visual grace and aggression and athleticism was to just make bigger wheels on them. And when you're in a company where, like BMW, they just don't do things for an aesthetic reason. They do things for a technical reason. It's an engineering company. So a bigger wheel is only a bigger wheel if some guy in the brake department decided he needed bigger brakes. And then you got a bigger wheel. Okay, so I mean, the whole chain of thought worked like that. They start with what is the world's best engineered car, and by the way, let's make a design that fits perfect. Not here's some designers who say it'd be really cool if you gave me this giant oversized wheel because it would make the car look better, and the engineers are saying you just added a whole bunch of weight and you didn't make the car drive any better. So let's say no. Okay, so we tried some different variations on aesthetics, and one of them that we worked with was this idea of flame surfacing, which try to find the dynamic of light on a surface in a non-traditional manner, which up until that time had been wedge shapes, wedge-shaped forms, and tapering forms. And instead we said, okay, let's let the light fade in, fade out, catch on a surface, and then be released by the surface in the same way that flickering flames are very dynamic, but they don't hold still. They keep your eye moving.
It seems like the auto industry has always kind of done a good job of sort of looking really deep into the future with concept cars. But it seems like there's this challenge now about bridging the gap between sort of the world of cars that we have inhabited for the last century and this future, which, you know, is no longer, you know, 30, 40, 50 years out, but is seems to be rapidly approaching thanks to these new technological developments. I'm really curious what your thoughts are in terms of like easing that transition just on an aesthetic basis and sort of balancing this sort of apparent, and maybe this is just my perception, but sort of inherent conservatism of the car market with sort of these new future opportunities.
There are definitely, I mean, you put your finger on about 10 different aspects, which are causing sleepless nights in a lot of OEMs, I think. And we didn't really talk a whole lot about self-driving cars, but autonomous vehicles, but they form in that mix of unknowns in the future in a very strong manner for people. Electric vehicles also taking their share of it. You're right. There are many things that design could be doing to ease this transition into the future. But maybe one of the problems that we have is we don't have enough experience with this future to really know what we're talking about. I'll just give you an example of the autonomous driving cars. All right. You know, the cool thing about being out in the countryside is, you know, you can take some cardboard and some wood and you can make a car if you want, because you're only driving around in a pasture. So it's okay. You know, you can see what happens. In fact, Reds, we did one of the earliest driving vehicles of Reds by taking a wooden mock-up of the interior and sticking a forklift up the butt, driving it around from a forklift. It was kind of cool. It worked. At least you understood what was happening. But, you know, if you were to take a piece of cardboard and make a self-driving car out of cardboard, it's not all that difficult, right? Well, all you have to do is kind of seal off the driver in your car with cardboard so you can't look at it. And then make a few discussions on how you want to communicate with that person driving. Do you want to tap on the cardboard? Do you want to write him a note so he sees it on his cell phone? Or do you want to yell at him through a little tube? You know, James, turn left. How do you want to do this? And just make sure that he only responds in a manner which is coherent with how this car should respond to you. I'm really interested in what it feels like just to be riding around up there. You know, do you even want to be in the front seat? Is it possible that the future of cars is one where, you know what, everybody wants the back seat? Imagine that. There is no front seat. There's only back seats. Just because we feel safer being a little bit further away from what's happening up there. Not really sure. All of those things of self-driving cars or how we see ourselves in vehicles and mobility in the future, they pose a bunch of unknowns on human behavior. And I believe that our let's say, our default conditions of what we say it's like, they're probably not correct. And so this, I think, takes a lot more experimentation and a lot more involvement of the designers in it. And that's what research is about. And let's hope that they do more of it.
So is the focus then a little bit more maybe on sort of the human factors aspect of this research than it was in the past in terms of understanding how people use a space rather than just saying like, they're going to be driving, so we're sitting there, so let's just focus on making the car look sexy from the outside kind of a thing.
Well, I mean, now you're running into the other thing is make it look sexy on the outside for who? So like if I don't own this car because I ordered the sexy Uber or what, you know, is that going to be the future? We're going to have Uber come in flavor, you know? I want the sexy Uber today. Oh, I don't want the sexy Uber. I want the dorky Uber. I don't know. It just seems kind of weird, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you look at the future forecast of privately owned vehicles as opposed to the number of vehicles out there, you know, this idea that private ownership is going to start taking a nosedive and you're going to have mass ownership through these, let's say, mobility providers, that changes the whole idea on who's deciding around here. You know, who's making a decision on what a car should look like? Will we have to make cars that in the future require not just one design per platform or two or three, but maybe 30 or 40? These are kind of unknowns because the business model for this future is also pretty unknown. Like, how are you going to make money on this?
So are you agnostic on the future of self-driving cars? Or do you believe that ownership will survive for some period of time? And if so, how long?
I went through a transition recently. I was one of these people who said, look, self-driving cars are inevitable. There's an inertia behind it. There's going to be a tipping point when people have a self-driving car in their family and then their kids aren't going to get driver's licenses because why bother? They haven't grown up with that. And then the results of people who do drive, their safety statistics are going to be so much worse, blah, blah, blah. And that's going to create this kind of movement where self-driving cars are just going to take over. However, in recent times, I've noticed that in almost all aspects of life, social, religious, anything you want, if you have a marginalized group, you can push them out for so long, and then they find a way to come back hard. And if we say the people who drive are going to be this ever, marginalized group, just like horse owners, okay, you want to drive a car, you go to a racetrack. Just like, you know, if you want to own a horse, you don't drive it down Main Street anymore. You have to ride it in a special pasture. If we say that about people who want to drive, we're going to marginalize them and push them out. I got a hunch, because they have a lot of financial interests on their side, that's going to come back in a boomerang way, really big way. And many of the potentials that self-driving cars have will not be realized because special interest groups are going to interfere with infrastructure changes, et cetera, necessary for them. So I'm not so certain that the self-driving car movement's going to go off without a hitch.
Are you familiar with an organization called the Human Driving Association?
Whoops. I'm going to say no.
Well, I just launched it 2 weeks ago, precisely to address what you just brought up. But I do so not because I'm opposed to self-driving cars or the safety and pollution solutions they bring, but because I think that a more nuanced approach makes sense and that we should embrace technology as it suits, human desire and agency. And I'm hoping to mitigate the effects of people taking a binary view of self-driving and its benefits.
So just to interject, I mean, that's kind of the job of a designer, right? Is to make sure that technology serves the human rather than sort of exists for its own sake. Do you agree with that?
Okay, well, I mean, now you've entered into something where I'm going to tell you the design world screwed up big time. I'm not really probably your best advocate for the philosophy of design at this time, because it's quite clear to me that design married the principles of modernism at the very outset, where, let's say, design moved into the modern world. We, the 20th century, we were the great advocates of modernism and the ideas that we follow from that, everything from form follows function to less is more, and anything you want to put like that, they all come from the tenets that were established by the modernists. And in doing so, we married the dark side of the force, because that side is a non-human side. Everything about the modernism of the industrial age was a culture that promoted machine values over human ones. And in fact, after a designer and the manager of the company he's working for, whatever, have decided this is the way this product is going to look, at that point on, every single human being involved in the process of bringing that thing to life is only measured on machine terms. Quality, cost, time. There's not 1 millimeter of space in a modern product for a human statement. Okay, I remember seeing a late 30s Alfa Romeo at one of these old timer shows, and it had two different exhaust pipes on it. It had a square exhaust pipe on one side and a round one on the other side. And I asked the guy whose car it was, I said, how come you didn't like fix that when you rebuilt it? He said, no, that's the way it came from the factory. I said, how come? And I said, I don't know, maybe, you know, Luigi was on Tuesday, put the round one on, and Mario on Wednesday, he put square ones on, because that's how he felt like. I don't know. But I thought that was wonderful. And in the one hand, you know, our world is full of great examples of the human touch. In fact, if you go see a movie, you get about 15 minutes of just credits at the end to show how many humans put their fingerprint on that film. But if you go see a phone or something like that, you would be shocked if not every one of those phones was hyper-identical to the point where the people involved in it are treated like machines. As a result, design has helped promote a world where machine values are preferable to human values. And in doing so, not only did we marginalize a large part of the world, you know, where can they go if we don't have a spot for them? They can only become fundamentalists, perhaps, or seek even darker ways to respond. Or we create a culture which, in the end of the day, decides it doesn't even need us. The whole AI discussion about where's there space for humans comes from that. So I think design maybe should reassess its role in creating a human-based world and see if we can do a little work on that.
And is that what the red vehicle does? It's reoriented towards human need as opposed to anything else?
I don't know. You know, that's kind of a nice way to put it. I like to think that my team and I had that in our hearts when we were doing it, and we tried to establish it. But at the same time, we want a very high-precision product too. So it'll be interesting to see how the humanism works in it. Certainly, it's a spot for you to find yourself. That's a start.
I can't believe we're basically out of time here, unfortunately. But this is just flown by because this is absolutely fascinating stuff. I guess before we go, sorry to cut you off, Alex, but before you go, what can people sort of maybe look forward to seeing from yourself or Chris Bangle Associates, and maybe where can they go to follow you online, either on social media or a website?
Well, yeah, my son prohibited me from having anything like a Twitter or Facebook or anything, you know.
Your son has your best interests at heart.
My son, Derek, yeah, he has my best interest. He says, you don't need another excuse to embarrass yourself in front of a billion people. I said, okay, I can buy into that.
We should all be so lucky to have someone like that in our
corner. He's looking after, sure. In fact, it's very nice to have someone in your house who is doing his doctoral work in design history, because Derek is very good at bringing these points to me. Many things that I talked to you about today actually come from discussions with him. So I want to give my son credit for that. Reds we have to bring into production, which we're doing now. That's one thing. And we do these cartoons that we started as a podcast a couple of years ago called Archy Arch. And those are now becoming a reality for many people here as we turn it into TV cartoons. This morning, before we had this little chat, I had a group here who teach children who can't see. And we make models of these characters for them, for the kids to feel and play with. And when they make stories out of them, we turn those into cartoons for them to present to kids who can see. And then together, with the help of the visually adept kids, they color them. And I tell you, it moves your heart to see these kids holding their hands like little templates to let these blind children color in a picture. That's absolutely fascinating.
Wow.
So we'll try and do things like that. Plus, sorry to tell you, but if you see the Big Bench movement we have here, it's called Big Bench Community Project, you will understand why to people in this area, cars, yeah, I guess so, but they all know me as the bench guy. So that's the other thing we do.
Cool. Well, we will include a link to Archy Arch. I'm actually really excited to check this out. I love cartoons, and it sounds really interesting. So we'll include a link to that in the post for this episode. Chris Bangle, thank you so much for joining us. I haven't said it yet.
Ed, Alex, thank you very much.
I'll say it now. I'm a huge fan. This has been a really gigantic honor. So thank you, and you know, feel free to come back anytime. You know, you've got other interesting stuff in the space happening.
You guys are very kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you.